Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, before we get into the episode, let's thank the people who support me on Patreon. Eddie the Head 83, Nick Beach, Mrs. Metal Dan, Sam Warwick, Kato Yokova, Adrian Cusick, Dane Damage, Madison Hatter, Seth B., Alan Janssen, Hank Reeves, John Simpson, Huckney Jacobson, Ed Ferguson, Denny Striegel, Patrick Sabin, Jerry from Salt Lake City, Blue Walsh 21, Victor Guzman, Gene Eugene DX, Sean Richmond, Mario Charance, Andrew Miller, Jeremy Weltman, Chris Riley, Johan Erdestrom, Stephen Rodriguez, Tommy Anderson, Gregory Muse, Kenny McCrimmon, Leo from Alaska, Brad Dahl, Dan Gerwan, Victor Ruiz, Sam Soupy, Drake, Matt Carroll, Joe Ryan, Jason Seth, Stephen Saylor, Ron Keel, Jean-Francois Blah, Anthony Mackey, James Bennett, David Gray, Fred Rutz, Michael Street, Mike Jones, Steve Hoker, John Bouvoiri, and Metal Dan. You too can support me on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com and search Talking Metal, or simply type in patreon.com/talkingmetal. If you want to catch up with other things related to me, you can check me out on social media. And of course, there's markstriegel.net. All the podcasts can be found at talkingmetal.com. On today's episode, we have Chuck Berge. Chuck is just an incredible drummer. He's been a friend for the last few years. And always love talking with him. This is part two. We did part one a while ago. It's linked through today's show notes. And I apologize. The quality of this interview sucks for some reason. It's very staticky, but you can definitely hear everything Chuck says. And I highly recommend you give it a try. It gets better as the interview goes on, because he says so much great stuff in here. So please listen to it. Bon Jovi, Blue Oyster Cult, Hall & Oates. We don't really get too much into the Ritchie Blackmore Rainbow stuff since we did that last time. And again, the last time, that podcast is linked in the show notes today. So what a great guy. What a great drummer. Chuck Berge. Here we go. Hey, it's Mark Striegel, and we are welcoming back to the podcast the extraordinary drummer, Chuck Berge. Chuck, how are you, man?
Mark, I'm well. And you?
I'm doing really well. We are just cranking out these podcasts, and I'm continuing to do my TV work during the day, all from home now, which I love. I don't have to commute to the office, so no complaints from me. I had you on back in 2019, and we did a big epic interview after Mitch LaFon had connected us, and I do want to just reference that for the listeners today, because there's a lot that was covered in that interview, and we're going to link that in today's show notes. Cool. And people can go back and hear all the Ritchie Blackmore stories, all the Billy Joel stories, and we're going to, but there was so much we didn't cover in the last interview. So we're going to try to cover some other stuff today. But first off, how are you, and how have you been holding up these past, 18, 19 months during this whole COVID craziness.
Yeah, well, after the COVID thing shut down the rest of our year, I guess it was in 2019, actually it was 2020, it was March, we played our last show with Billy. So that was in Mexico City. It was an awesome show. And then we got home and like within 10 days, it was suddenly stuff is shut down. So Billy has been an unbelievable friend and boss. He kept everybody on salary for 2020.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Yeah. That's something you don't hear in the press either. That's great. Wow.
Yeah, no one's tooting his horn, but he made the difference for the whole band and the whole crew. I mean, our whole, not obviously everybody, but lighting guys, sound guys, everybody was kept on salary for 2020.
That's incredible. That's really unheard of. Wow. Yeah, we've heard about so many people just, you know, struggling through this time.
Absolutely. I heard some horror stories during that time off, which, as it turned out, was the longest break I'd ever had. And I know that I'm probably speaking for all my musician friends. But yeah, Billy was extraordinary. And we started up again this summer after a lot of fitful planning, because it seems the only places you can actually perform are places where the mayor of the city and the governor have agreed on protocols.
Ah, wow. Okay.
So we started in Boston at Fenway, which was sold out and from a year ago last summer, a summer ago. And then we went to Buffalo Bills Stadium, which was sold out. And then we did Cincinnati, the Great American Ballpark. And that was sold out. So that was the last gig a couple of weeks ago.
Wow.
We're on our way on the 22nd of this month to Austin, Texas, where we'll be performing after the final race, the NASCAR race. They have a huge facility in Austin, Texas. And if anybody has any interest, they should Google it, because there's a huge stage that they've erected for performances. So I don't think we're bringing a whole lot of gear. We're bringing the band gear, I think, and maybe sound. I don't know how it's laid out, but there's a huge futuristic viewing tower behind where the stage is, and it's mind-boggling. So I've never been there. I've only seen pictures, but we head out on the 22nd, and we are the we're the entertainment.
Wow, that's amazing. That sounds like a fun event for sure.
It certainly will be.
And one of my favorite concerts, thanks to you, was in 2019, Billy Joel and Chuck Berge on stage at Madison Square Garden. Wow, what a great night that was. And Billy usually does what, like once a month, sometimes more than once a month at the Garden?
We've been doing once a month at the Garden for 7 years up until what would have been March of 2020. So literally within 10 days of us getting back from Mexico, we were supposed to be at the Garden. That was rescheduled at the time, and then the whole year was canceled. So, but up until that point, it had been every month solid for 7 years.
Wow.
And so like, I'm personally on, I think, my 85th sellout in a row at the Garden.
Wow. And have they announced Garden shows coming back for Billy Joel? I know we have the Foo Fighters played and the Eagles played. So there's definitely concerts happening there.
Yep. So we're back there for the very first time on November 5th. We will be at MSG for the first
soon.
Time. Almost 2 years. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's great news. And I do need to, before we get into your just amazing history that we didn't cover last time, okay. I need to ask you for an update with Tokyo Motor Fist. You guys put out an album basically in the middle of this whole pandemic thing.
Oh, man. Yeah.
And any updates on that?
Not really. The last gig they had was at a Monsters of Rock kind of festival in South Jersey here. And Steve, I was unable to do it. So we got this great, great drummer. I'm trying to think of his full name, Jordan Kanata. Okay. And he's a Long Island kid, I believe. And so they got him to be the ringer for the show. But we've had a couple of shows canceled. So obviously melodic, hard rock, a la the 80s kind of vibe. It's not huge in America. for the most part. So we're waiting to see what happens, and I have a feeling we might be off for the rest of the year. We have been invited back to the Monsters of Rock cruise. I believe that's in February of 2022. So I'm not sure exactly of the date of that, but that could be our first startup again.
Okay, and you think you'll be playing with them on the cruise?
So it doesn't you know, conflict with something Billy's already planned, because they know that's
priority. Sure,
that's the main job and priority. So yeah, and I'm looking forward to that. Hopefully that'll happen. I don't feel much of anything else is going to happen. Usually those type of shows have to be a multi-bill for all those bands to actually make it worthwhile for the promoters. So I don't think we're doing much for the rest of the year. But you mentioned that album Lions, which I'm so proud of, and I think it was the apex of the leader of Stevie Brown on guitar and vocals. I think it was the apex of his writing career so far. I mean, it's just an awesome album, but sadly it did come out towards the end of the plandemic, and I don't think it got any of the traction that it should have. And I actually really feel that Frontiers dropped the ball on what I thought was could have been a huge album for them. They're an Italian-based company,
and right,
we just don't see eye to eye with the way they handled that last album. So that's the update on TMF.
Yeah, well, we do encourage everyone to check out Tokyo Motor Fist's last record from 2020, Lions. Again, a great listen. We had Steve on the podcast to talk about it at the time it came out, or right around there. But let's dive into some of your history. One of the things we didn't talk about the last time was your involvement with Hall & Oates. Can you tell us how that came about and how long you were with them?
Yeah, I was just leaving a kind of fusion band that was based up in Toronto. So that year, 1980, started with me being unsure as to what I was going to do. And I got a call from a friend of a friend. I think it was a friend of the bass players. And they said, you should call John, the bass player for Hall & Oates at the time, because they're looking to audition drummers. So I literally, you know, I'm so fortunate. I grew up in Montclair, which was 12 miles from Manhattan, Midtown. So getting into town, even when I was much younger, was just a bus ride. But I called somebody, set up an audition, played for them. And I know they went through a bunch of other people. But lucky for me, I got the, like, okay, they want you to do this. So it was a radical change in the direction of my playing. And it was one of the most extraordinary year and a half I had ever had. I finished an album that they had in the can that Jerry Marotta had played on most of the big songs on. And I played a couple of songs to finish the album out. One of them was a remake of Loving Feeling by the Righteous Brothers. And that was their second single released from that record. And it went top 40. And it was so cool to hear myself on the radio, AM radio, for the first time.
Right.
And so we got ready to do a tour, which lasted most of the year of 1980. And it was just an extraordinary, extraordinary year for me. Working with them was amazing. They were super cool, super fun, and we worked hard. We were on the bus a lot, and just it was a kind of comeback album for them. It's called Voices, and it has since gone double platinum, I believe. Maybe multi.
Right.
Wow. So that was it. It kind of came out because John Sigler, who was the bass player in that band at the time, had known and gotten me into another band eventually. In any case, he was good friends with them. I knew him. And it was just friends of friends. And then making the time to go in and audition And I played too much. In fact, if I ever get to see Daryl and John again, I'd have to thank them for putting up with me until I really settled into the gig. Because I was coming off of like Brand X fusion type music.
Yeah.
And I played way too much. But you know, they were kind and let me do it. Yeah. I look back and listen to some of our live stuff and, oh my God, they were so kind to not have fired me. So thanks, wow. Thanks, Daryl.
Right on. And like I said, we deeply cover your involvement with Rainbow on two different stints you had with them. That's on episode 812 of this podcast. So we're going to encourage everyone to go back and listen to that. But let's stay in the 80s now, and let's talk about the very first Bon Jovi record, which was released in January 84. So I'm guessing probably recorded in 83. Yep. What was your involvement with that record? Because, you know, we know the Bon Jovi band, but were they really on that record? Like, what did you play on the first Bon Jovi record?
I played five songs, and I don't remember their names, but I do have the album. I should someday maybe just listen to it and go, okay, that was one. So I got involved with that because, let me see if I can get this straight here.
Were you on the Runaway single, the big single?
No. That was a Frank LaRocca, and he was actually an A&R guy for, I believe, Atlantic Records. He was, he loved to play rock and roll. So I believe he played on that and that own that song and that song only. So let's see. I had out of Hall & Oates, I joined a band called Balance, and they were on CBS, and they were produced and recorded by Tony Bon Jovi, and Tony at the time was co-owner of the Power Station in New York.
So John's uncle, I believe, right?
Yeah. And so real briefly, while I was recording their record, which I believe was my first album at the Power Station, I got to know John because John was the night janitor. And I don't want to paint it too weird, but, you know, he was the night kid. He came in and emptied all the and just cleaned up after all the sessions. So I got to talking to him while we were recording the Balance album, which was called In for the Count on CBS Epic Records. And then through working with Tony, I started doing other sessions at the Power Station. I ended up doing Michael Bolton's first solo album. And in the course of working with engineers and producers, it was through Tony, he suggested me to a guy named Lance Quinn. Lance was producing, and I believe was the producer of a lot of Bon Jovi's first record. Maybe not Runaway, but so Lance called me and said, hey, I got your number from Tony. I'm working with a band. You might know the singer, Johnny. And I was like, oh, my God, he's doing something. Because he was just a gorgeous-looking kid. And it was just, dude, when are you going to do a band? And he'd shrug and say, you know, I'm working on it. In any case, so that was it. I met with the producer, went in. I believe some of the tracks already had rough stuff done. I didn't play, to the best of my knowledge, with anybody in the band. And it's stuff was already done. So I did five songs and that was it. So it's ended up being a golden platinum album on my wall. And I initially was given credit, God, I think as a bass player.
Really? Just by accident, by mistake?
No, I think it was because I was in another band. I think I was in Balance at the time, and I was working with a bunch of other artists, and maybe they just wanted to keep it looking like, okay, Tico drums, you know, so-and-so bass, and keep it looking like a band on minor notes.
Right.
I've eventually been credited with drums, you know, auxiliary personnel, I think, something like that.
Right. I know on Wikipedia it says additional drums, but you're saying that you played the drum tracks on five of those songs.
Yeah. And I don't remember what they were. And I, you know, it had to be done quick. So I was still learning my way around sessions, which was a whole new world for me. And it was all to a click. So the stuff had already been recorded. And I guess Lance wanted to replace some drums or whatever. So that was it. It was through Tony Bon Jovi and having been in a band that recorded at the Power Station. So it was
cool.
Really, that ended up, I ended up having a lot of work through that connection and meeting a lot of great people. So, you know, like anything in the business, you meet one person if you do a decent job and you're a cool person or at least dealable, then things can keep moving forward.
Right on. And one thing we didn't get to talk about the last time I spoke with you at all, which I know a lot of people were wondering about because we have fans of Blue Oyster Cult who listen to this show. Let's talk about your involvement with Blue Oyster Cult, which was substantial. I mean, most of the 90s, you were with them?
Half of the 90s. I think I joined them in 91 and left in 95. So it was about 4.5 years.
Okay. All right.
And I loved working with them. So I met them during the last two summers of doing outdoor festivals in America and Europe when I was with Meatloaf. So they got a chance to, you know, I didn't know they were auditioning me, but they were. So they checked me out. And when Meat decided to pull the whole band off the road to start the process, the long, painful process of him recording Back Into Hell, which ended up being incredibly successful. But
right.
All of us needed to look for work. So literally within 10 days of him telling everyone, I think we're done for now, at least for a year or two, I got a call from their manager. And he was like, hey, you know, the guys want to know if you want to start playing with them. Their drummer's leaving. And I had seen them and thought, yeah. And I'd been big fans of their music. So literally, it was a great segue. I wasn't out of work long. We played a lot of big shows, and then we played a million smaller ones, clubs or county fairs. I mean, all over the country. So my time with them was just a lot of fun. I was big fans of theirs from the very beginning, and then touring with them, you know. They're some of the icons of the old school. So it was a real pleasure to work with them. I did two records. I was saying Cult Classics, which is our attempt to recreate their original hits, like note for note. And then the second album, which I'm really proud of, was Heaven Forbid, and there's some really fun and very cool tracks. And we were going real heavy. I was going real heavy for that one.
And there's some tremendous drumming on that album specifically. Now you mentioned you left them in 95, but that record came out a little later, didn't it?
You know what? I think it did. I really didn't follow it as to when it came out. And, you know, what happened was things had just really slowed down after the recording of that record in terms of gigs. And... you know, I wanted to be a band member, and they really couldn't afford to let that happen. So when an opportunity came to join Richie's World Tour again, that was 95.
Rainbow, yeah.
You know, I literally said yes and called them and said, listen, I got a guy who will take my place for any of the gigs until you get somebody to stay. And I didn't want to leave him in a lurch, but I had been with them long enough for them to... have made a business proposition to me that made sense, and it didn't really happen. So I just felt, you know, it was in my best interest to move on at that point.
Right, right. Totally understandable.
Yeah, and, you know, and I love them, and, but at the time, there were three of them. I know Alan, the original piano player, guitar player, passed a couple of years ago. So, but at the time, there was three of them who were the original from the original and founding members, and whatever, they didn't want to part with any more percentages of what they had, and I get it. So it was fine. I mean, Richie made my mind up for me with a really great offer and a year's worth of work. So that was fun to go back to that. But yeah, I had a blast with BOC. Loved those guys. Loved working with Buck, and I think they've got a great band now. One of my favorite bass players, Danny Miranda, is playing with them and has been. I listened to most of their new album, which came out last year.
Yeah, it just turned a year old. The Symbol Remains, the new album, is terrific.
Yeah, Symbol Remains. I think it's an amazing record, and it's so captured what I think they were all about when they began. And they're a swinging rock and roll band. Rich Castellano, their drummer. But I think it's an incredible band. And most people don't know that they had a great live record out from a couple of years ago now. I think it's on Frontiers. And I think the new one's on Frontiers also. So I think they've had better luck with the Italian company Frontiers than TMF has.
Right on.
But I love that new album, and it really, it's I'm a huge fan. I called Buck up after hearing it, and we caught up and reconnected again, and oh my God. Yeah, so it was a wonderful time in my life. I really am grateful for the opportunity to have played all those classic songs inside out. And I've got some live stuff, live footage and moments that I was with them that were, I'm really proud of. So it was a lot of fun. And we went all over the planet with that band. A lot of touring.
Right on. And Chuck, we will have to wrap things up in a minute, but I did want to mention Bob Kulick. We lost him, I guess, within the last year. And you had a history with Bob and played with him. Balance? Was that what you played?
Yeah, I met Bobby in the band Balance. And incidentally, people can go to Facebook or Bruce Kulick's, I think, YouTube page, because I just played on a tribute to Bob. I'm going to forget it now. It's by Balance, written by Pepe Castro, The World I Used to Know. And there's a great video that was put together by the keyboard player, Doug Katsaris. And we got Bruce Kulick to play guitar on it. And he's in the video as well. So it's a video tribute song to Bobby. And I'm really proud of it. I think it came out great. Whether it ever leads to anything else, at least it's a real capper to having known those guys, and for Bobby to have been in all of our lives, and as a tribute to him. So The World I Used to Know, by Balance on Facebook, and I think you can find it on Bruce Kulick's page on YouTube as well.
Cool. We're going to link that through the show notes in today's podcast.
Oh, please.
And we are so excited that live gigs are returning. I saw Pearl Jam recently and Megadeth. So I'm back in the concert mode. Right. Cannot wait to see you on stage. We've got to see Billy, if not this year, definitely in 2022. I want to come back and rock out at the Garden with you.
You know how to reach out to me, and we'll get you in. I'm hoping if all goes well, we're into all of next year, which is pretty much of it is sold already at the Garden.
Wow.
So here's hoping we got another year to go without any technical difficulties from the CDC world.
Right on. Yeah. Cool.
Mark, this has been such a pleasure, and thank you again. I could blab about all this stuff for hours, so anytime you want to do a part three.
we will do a part three. I can promise you that. Might be a year or so, but we will
whenever,
do a part
my
three.
Friend, you got plenty of other people to say hello to and listen to. So thank you again for the opportunity.
You bet. And thank you for the great music with Rainbow, Blue Oyster Cult, Bon Jovi, Hall & Oates, Tokyo Motor Fist, and of course Billy Joel, and many, many others that we're leaving off the list right now. But you've had quite a career, and it goes onward. Thank you, Chuck.
I'm blessed, and thank you, Mark. Have a great day, and bye everybody out in Radio Land.
Big thanks to Chuck Berge for joining me. Really hope to see him playing with Billy Joel again soon. Big thanks to you for listening. Please support me on Patreon. A $5 a month pledge gets you a Talking Metal t-shirt. Thank you. Talk to you next time.